Okay. First of all, I want to thank my old friend Erica for having me here. She's not done yet. She's going to turn into a tour guide after I come back from Edinburgh. So she's earning it, man, let me tell you. But it's great to be here. I went for a run this morning, which was wonderful. I feel like a local now, having run along the river and the kind of drizzle, you know, 48 degree drizzle, so that was good. Let me just tell you a little bit about this talk. This is probably not the best talk to start the day with. It's a little bit long, and you're probably going to find it a little bit dense. I don't mean dense in the sense of unclear. I just mean dense in the sense of a lot of stuff packed into the talk. For that, I apologize. You know, the other talks, I've seen them queuing up their PowerPoints. They're going to be a lot more fun than my talk and a lot more interesting, probably. Definitely a lot more multidimensional in terms of media. I just have slides of text and stuff, so so it's pretty old school in that regard. The last thing I'll say before I get going is this is part of a big project. It's probably going to end up being actually two books on what I'm calling ecological poetics. And what I'm trying to do in the project is re-describe what ecological poetics means in ways that the tradition of eco-criticism hasn't, I think, really done that well. So I've written about 15,000 words on deconstruction and theoretical biology, of which this is just a very, very brief snippet. So thank your lucky stars I'm not reading you the whole 15,000 words, because you'd be probably suicidal at the end of it. But anyway, that's just the big echo chamber for the for the project, and we can, obviously, I'm happy to answer questions about some of those other dimensions. Wallace Stevens's poetry will probably end up being one book of this two-book project, so I'm going to lay out the theoretical and philosophical and biological material in volume one, and then and talk about contemporary art as well. And then in volume two, I'm going to really drill down with Stevens's poetry. So, given the theme of this year's conference, I want to talk about sound, hearing, and animals, specifically birdsong. A couple of poems that muse upon the experience of hearing birdsong and the poetics thereof, which I'll want to re-describe in post-naturalistic and post-representational terms, drawing on some recent work in theoretical biology and ornithology, to make it clear that a properly post-humanist understanding of the animal is one that is always already ecologized. What I mean is that, whether we're talking about human or non-human beings, what's crucial is not the taxonomy of human or animal, but rather the dynamic organism and environment relationship, which consists of a concatenation of processes that obey the logic of what Jacques Derrida calls iterability and the trace that may eventuate in certain forms of life and behavior, but don't necessarily have to. This is being brought into sharp focus at the moment by work in theoretical biology, epigenetics, and immunology that I can't go into here, but which forms the larger context for what I'll talk about today, as I just mentioned. Life, in other words, is one possible outcome of the recursive concatenation of material processes that obey the logic of the trace, but it's certainly not the only or expected one. And to put it this way is to realize that the rejection of biologistic continuism, as Derrida puts it, actually makes possible a much more robust naturalistic account of the processes that give rise to to domains that cannot be reduced to the biological alone, or more radically still, in fact, to the organic alone. Why not? Because what binds together the human addresser and the animal addressee is not just their shared finitude as embodied beings, their shared mortality, but also how that embodiment is interlaced with a mechanicity, a technicity, and an automaticity of the semiotic programs and codes that extend far beyond the individual organism, whether we're talking about the genome, hardwired its instinctive behaviors, or language itself. It's not just a question of our relations to non-human forms of life, in other words. It's also a question of a more profound and, as it were, non-representational form of relation that obtains in our address to the non-human other, one that has to do with the very means by which relations themselves to non-human others, between non-human others, and to ourselves may take place at all. So that what we share in our being with the animal is a second form of finitude, as I put it in What is Posthumanism, that obtains in our subjection to any semiotic system whatsoever that makes possible our concepts, our recognition, and our articulation of our non-human relations in the first place. Now, as we all know, birds are central to the Anglo-American poetic tradition, and beyond that, Shelley Skylark, Keats Nightingale, Poe's Raven, Hopkins Windhover, the list goes on and on. But what distinguishes the strongest and most interesting bird poems is not just their fascination with the radically inhuman or ahuman nature of this other form of life and the knowledge that it brings us. That's a standard feature of the bird-bard matrix in the poetic tradition, after all, with the bird as a fellow singer and messenger from another domain. Rather, it's the complicated way in which these poems detranscendentalize that interaction through a poetics that stages what has been called a kind of denaturalized naturalism. One of the more well-known entries in the Bird Bard sweepstakes is the poem by Robert Frost that gives my lecture its title, "Never Again Would Bird Song Be the Same." He would declare, and could himself believe, that the birds there and all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as it may, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would bird song be the same, and to do that to birds was why she came. Now, the first thing everyone will notice about this poem is that it's a sonnet, more specifically an Elizabethan or Shakespearean sonnet, so called because it ends in a rhyme couplet. The second piece of literary historical heavy artillery that Frost puts on the table in this poem is the pastoral mode, Virgilian or classical, if we believe John Hollander's reading. And the third is the mythopoetic invocation, again to use Hollander's phrase, of Adam, Eve, and the Garden of Eden. But here, we find something interesting. Two things, actually. The first is the poem's insistence that an eloquence so soft could only have had this effect on bird song when call or laughter carried it aloft. In short, this is emphatically not, to my mind, a mythopoetics of the biblical fall and how one might understand the relationship between Eve's song and bird song within its purview. And this leads us very directly and in short order to Derrida's entire discussion, which many of you are familiar with, and his rejection of what he calls the various sacrificial symbolic economies at the core of the Abrahamic religious traditions that secure the transcendence of the properly human, of what calls itself man, as he puts it, by means of sacrificing the animal and the animality of the human itself. This is not a poem, in other words, about the realization of original sin in the Garden of Eden, and how such a realization activates the sacrificial symbolic economies of guilt and expiation that try to elevate the human and its song above the rest of creation, especially serpents in this case. But nor is it, I think, a mythopoetic affirmation of the oneness of creation, human and non-human, before the biblical fall, when the Garden of Eden was still a place of call or laughter and not of sin and guilt. The issue here is not exactly, as the psychoanalytically inclined among us would point out, that any human registration of the so-called fact of nature is always already radically denaturalized because of the symbolic and imaginary realms that make the presence of nature manifest to us in their different ways are anything but natural. Or as Slavoj Žižek put it now 25 years ago, and it's kind of hard to believe it's been that long, but as he puts it, quote, "The fact that man is a speaking being means precisely that he is, so to speak, constitutively derailed, an open wound of the world, as Hegel put it, that excludes man forever from the circular movement of life, so that all attempts to regain a new balance between man and nature can only be a form of fetishistic disavowal." It's rather that everything Žižek says does not apply only to human beings, because we aren't the only speaking beings in the full sense intended here, as we'll see. A desire to split the difference between the two mythopoetic stances noted above, prelapsarian holism on the one hand and immanence or postlapsarian transcendence on the other, is at work in some of the earlier criticism, I think, but it needs to be re-described in terms of the theoretical literature we have available to us now, not just philosophical, but biological and zoological. Now, I have no intention, of course, of exhaustively surveying the literature on the poem or its place in Frost's corpus. But take, for example, this snippet from Robert Kern's essay on Frost and Modernism, which finds in the poem a focus on a substratum of speech that can apparently cross over from human beings to birds and be reproduced by them in a way that thereafter becomes meaningful to human ears, or at least perceptible as song. This crossing over can take place, however, only because it is not meaning but sound that the birds pick up and convey. In Frost's conception, one which plays an interesting variation on traditional notions of linguistic origins, the language of spoken words is preceded or underlain by a language of sounds without words. And like most notions of an original or ideal language, this one is both prior to actual speech and so free of the problems of signification and somehow communicative nevertheless. Or let's linger even longer over John Hollander's observation that the animating myth of the poem is that of the imprinting of consciousness onto nature. Hereafter, the poem says, nature would exist as a meaningful communicant, to be listened to because human meaning would always be in it, her tone of meaning, but without the words. He meant the delicate but crucial modulations of phrase stress pattern, contrast of stress, the rhetorical supersegmentals that not only make oral communication what it is, but which a practitioner of classical accentual syllabic verse must be aware of. It is the music of English verse in which syntax plays a necessarily important role. And this is a quote from Frost, just so many sentence sounds belong to man as just so many vocal runs belong to one kind of bird, he writes to Sidney Cox in 1914. We come into the world with them and create none of them. What we feel as creation is only selection and grouping. We summon them from heaven knows where under excitement with the audile imagination, unquote. The sound of sense, the music of speech, but of speech being watched in its transcribed form, within a diagramming and punctuating and annotating grid of metrical pattern. To this degree, we all still dwell in the romantic world of the ear. The ear's larger, undomesticated vastnesses, those regions in which real poetry rather than cultivated verse is to be found, the realm of all the human and natural utterance, from cries of pain to shouts of discovery, the sounds of language and of the wind in the trees. Before I place these observations alongside contemporary biological theory on bird song, I want to stress two points before moving forward. First, we have here the larger assertion of a shared form of meaning among and between human and non-human beings that is emphatically not reducible to language per se. And I've written a lot about this work stretching back to Gregory Bateson's writings on mammalian and cetacean communication, for example. As we shall see, it's far from fanciful in either contemporary philosophy or contemporary biology to entertain the possibility of a shared form of meaning between human and non-human beings. But second, and this is crucial because it defeats any attempt one might make toward a reductionist account based on an overextension and misunderstanding of point one, while Frost writes to Sidney Cox that just so many sentence sounds belong to man as just so many vocal runs belong to one kind of bird, it's also emphatically and obviously the case with this poem, as Hollander shrewdly observes, that we have here, quote, the music of speech, but of speech being watched in its transcribed form, within a diagramming and punctuating and annotating grid, unquote, which, in its emphasis on the poem's self-reference, short-circuits Hollander's own backsliding elision of, quote, the sounds of language and the wind in the trees, in his too rapid distinction between real poetry and cultivated verse. For that is one of the very, excuse me, that is one of the very strangest things about this poem, its cultivation. And what I want to draw your attention to here is what an earlier type of literary criticism would call, disparagingly, the poem's excessively and quite explicitly foregrounded rhetorical quality. What we might call its weak, artificial, and equivocal, rather than univocal, in the sense of a naturalistic eminence, poetics. That's already at work in the differentiation between, here, I'll go back to the poem here. Whoops. That's already at work in the differentiation between sound, song, speech, and speech observed in Hollander's gloss. These are obviously four quite different things. But also, and most obviously, in the rhetorical surface of Frost's poem from the very first line, the heavily modal and conditional, he would declare and could himself believe. as if he, and it's not really clear who he is, an unnamed contemporary speaker or Adam, could, but also might not believe a prior antecedent declaration about the nature of what he's hearing in the bird song in the garden. The main force of the line, I would suggest, is to foreground, and in a pretty stilted way, I would say, its ungrammatical and rhetorical performance, establishing thereby even more distance between the event and the emotions generated by the event, whence the need to declare instead of simply to acknowledge and receive something that he later himself might or might not believe. To my mind, Frost goes out of his way to foreground the fact that whatever's going on here, it's exactly the opposite of an unmediated, unconditional affirmation of the bird song and what it means in all its intoxicating beauty and power. But be that as it may, to borrow from another of Frost's own weird phrasings in the poem, the same rhetorical conditionality threads its way throughout the poem in, admittedly, could only, be that as it may, moreover, and probably, consistently exerting a kind of corrosive and denaturalizing rhetoricity on the poem as it unfolds, so that by the time we get to the last line of the poem, we are forced to choke down the provisionality of why she came to do something to birdsong that in fact has only a probable chance of success. Now, I hope you find all of this as weird as I do, all of it smuggled inside the overpowering Trojan horse of the herd-bird poetic tradition. And the main point I want to make is that it is counter-Adamic, and yet, because of its rhetoricity, not about naturalistic holism either. As we'll see with birdsong itself, what's natural about it, in a weird way, is that it's not natural. And as I've noted elsewhere, we find exactly the same sort of thing in one of Wallace Stevens's most important bird poems, the late masterpiece, Not Ideas About the Thing, But the Thing Itself, which we can only begin to discuss by first noting that the title is already an intertextual permutation of William Carlos Williams's famous shibboleth, No Ideas But in Things, from Book One of Patterson, the sensibility of which Stevens had famously engaged in a notorious review of Williams, one of the most important short prose pieces that he ever wrote. In other words, to put it bluntly, this poem that is supposedly about not ideas, but the thing itself, is in fact, right out of the gate, about ideas about the thing, in the form of an elusive intertextuality. What we find in Stevens's poem, I would suggest, is the same kind of weak or slack poetics, the same kind of obsessively foregrounded rhetoricity that we find in Frost's poem as the poet's way of framing a response to the event of hearing birds song. This is Stevens's poem. At the earliest ending of winter, in March, a scrawny cry from outside seemed like a sound in his mind. He knew that he heard it, a bird's cry, at daylight or before, in the early March wind. The sun was rising at 6, no longer a battered panache above snow. It would have been outside. It was not from the vast ventriloquism of sleep's faded papier-mâché. The sun was coming from outside. That scrawny cry, it was a chorister whose C preceded the choir. It was part of the colossal sun, surrounded by its choral rings, still far away. It was like a new knowledge of reality. Here, to put it very telegraphically, what cannot be missed, I think, is how the scrawniness of the bird's cry is matched, weakness for weakness, you might say, by the scrawniness of the poem, and its heavily mediated immediacy, its im-mediacy, by the phalanx of prepositions that Stevens forces us to walk through, at, in, of, from, and most crucially, by and like. A weakness and an immediacy only redoubled by the fact that it's not a sound in his mind, but like a sound in his mind, or more forcefully still, because weaker still, I think, it seemed like a sound in his mind. And we need, moreover, to be told, again, oddly enough, I think, that he knew he heard it. This makes us wonder, with the speaker of the poem, where did it come from, this new knowledge of reality that is only like a new knowledge of reality, this C that is also crucially a pre-C that comes before the choir and also comes before the letter C at the beginning of the word choir. To fully burn in a sense of this heightened foregrounding of rhetoricity and performativity in these Heard Bird poems by Frost and Stevens, contrast them to the opening of Robert Morgan's remarkable poem Mockingbird from 1975. Morgan's poem piles on the figuration, and specifically piles on the metaphors, while giving almost no room at all to the merely grammatical and rhetorical elements that take front and center and at key moments in the poems of Frost and Stevens. Morgan launches the poem in classic fashion, the poet being inspired, thrilled even, by the sound of the mockingbird arriving in the fading light. While the bee sleeps in the southern night and weeds weigh under dowries of dew, above the distant honky-tonk of falls in the July dark, before the katydids, when the only frost is lunar, a voice that raises the hackles on mountains and chills the barometric spine, that radios through many channels in the crab orchard and from maples above the road. What madrigal is watering the night with polyphony? You could see orchestras and oratorios in the polyglot dark, not so much a mocking of the many-voiced populations as a gathering to unlikely congregation of all song, an anthology including rooster and cricket broadcast from an ounce of hot flesh through its briar tongue and filling the hollows and thickets and dry ditches of the river valley and soaking under eaves to the inner ear's accelerator, circling quick into sleep and bombarding the ledges of dream. Now, this description will probably resonate with anyone who has actually heard the mockingbird do its thing, especially in the spring months. And in the ornithological literature, the mockingbird is indeed a superstar polyphonic madrigalist, as Jennifer Ackerman reports in her best-selling book, The Genius of Birds, which I'm extremely happy to hear has come up a bunch of times in conversation and also in papers in the conference. I haven't read the whole thing, I'm about halfway through it, but I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. Darwin, as for mockingbirds, Darwin found them everywhere in South America during his voyage on the Beagle, and declared their song, quote, far superior to that of any other bird in the country, unquote. But here's the interesting thing, and interesting in light of what we have been discussing with Frost and Stevens' rhetoricity and intertextuality. As Ackerman notes, quote, mockingbirds have been maligned as mere thieves who pilfer tunes and miss the main musical point of their stolen songs, unquote, which in some cases have been reported to consist of 39 bird songs, 50 bird calls, as well as the sounds of frogs, crickets, car alarms, squeaky pumps, and dogs barking, among others. But though, quote, calls are typically short, simple, succinct, and innate, while songs are generally longer, more complex, and learned, there is, in fact, she writes, no neat division between call and song, and there are plenty of exceptions, unquote. Part of the reason this is so, as David Wills notes in a fascinating chapter of his book In Animation on Descartes called Meditation for the Birds, is even birds with a repertoire far smaller than that of the mockingbird may sing both accented and unaccented versions of their songs, one to patrol territory and one for attracting mates, the two functions of bird song that are taken in the ornithological literature to be axiologic. There's lots of disagreement, in fact, about what constitutes a different song, and even with a middle-of-the-road songbird like the cardinal, it is said by one authority to possess 8 to 12 songs, and by another to be capable of an innumerable quantity of different tunes. And this fact, when crossed with the territory versus mating and accented versus unaccented factors, leads to a whole series of other questions. Is a song, Wills asks, quote, a verse or rather a refrain? Are the birds making music or simply mimicking, parroting, or aping themselves? Is their song a call and response, a chant, or simply a repetition? Is it a theme and variation, indeed an improvisation, or rather a mechanical repetition, or indeed reproduction? Those questions might also be tantamount to asking what life is in it, unquote, he writes, and moreover to asking after the extent to which we are in the presence of a genuine response expressed in the bird's call, or merely a mechanical and instinctive reaction. At which point, of course, we're right back to the terrain from Derrida that we started with, how the mechanicity and technicity of the trace, upon which communication is dependent, destabilizes and deconstructs the opposition between responding and merely reacting that has underwritten the hierarchical ontology of the human over the animal. In the light of which, one might say that the excessive rhetoricity of the poems by Frost and Stevens, which foreground the inescapably performative and iterative nature of meaning, which is not, we now know, limited to the domain of the human, thematizes and stages the bond between human beings and animals, but in a post-humanist and non-representational way, by the poets not so much refusing, as it were, to be human, but rather foregrounding, through the inescapably performative rhetorical nature of the utterance, the impossibility of being human, as something understood to be indexed to a secure partitioning off of the difference between genuinely responding and merely reacting. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that all of the above, the uncertain relationship between call and song, between reaction and response, and so on, is at the very core of the current ornithological literature on birdsong. As Ackerman notes, quote, "Many people assume that birdsongs are genetically encoded, but the birds go through the same process of vocal learning that people do. They listen to adult exemplars, they experiment and they practice, honing their skills like children learning a musical instrument," unquote. And just as with a human being practicing an instrument to build muscle memory, quote, "it takes practice, trial, and error, hearing your mistakes and correcting them. If you want to retain the phrase, it means repeating it often enough to reinforce the brain pathways that created the memory in the first place," unquote. As she notes, quoting again, "mockingbirds are really, really good at this. Sonograms comparing a prototype song and the mockingbird's copy show that the imitator sings nuthatch and thrush and whippoorwill with almost perfect fidelity to the original script," unquote. Moreover, she notes, and I think this is really fascinating, quote, "scientists found that when a mockingbird sings a cardinal's song, it actually mimics the actual muscular patterns of the cardinal itself," unquote. We find here a kind of literalization in the flesh of the very technicity, automaticity, and mechanicity that's on display in perhaps the greatest heard bird poem of all in Wallace Stevens's work, Of Mere Being, one of the last poems Stevens ever wrote. The poem at the end of the mind, beyond the last thought, rises in the bronze decor. A gold-feathered bird sings in the palm, without human meaning, without human feeling, a foreign song. You know then that it is not the reason that makes us happy or unhappy. The bird sings, its feathers shine. The palm stands on the edge of space. The wind moves slowly in the branches. The bird's fire-fangled feathers dangle down. As with Stevens, it's not ideas about the thing but the thing itself, let's begin again with the title. The word mere may mean only or just, of course, as it's usually taken, and as such is apparently deflationary, if not pejorative. But it may also mean essential or very, the very being of being, capital B, as it were, but a kind of being that is the real thing only because it is merely what it is. That is to say, in a sense, because it is not what it is. This is not just a case, I think, of being's essence being turned inside out, subordinated to becoming, as we're familiar with, but actually something more radical, foreign, and strange, because radically denaturalized by the technicity and rhetoricity that I've been discussing. Such a reading is made unavoidable, I think, by the thinly veiled allusion here to Yeats's bird in Sailing to Byzantium, which every critic of this poem has noticed, in the bird in Stevens's poem who may be gold-colored or may be made of gold, an allusion itself clenched by the alliterative doubling and resequencing of Yeats's chiasmic hammered gold and gold enameling by Stevens's fire-fangled feathers dangle down. And here's just the last part of the last half of Yeats's poem. O sages standing in God's holy fire as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make, of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake. or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come. Stevens' poem shares Yeats's rejection of naturalism, to be sure, but it also, and equally importantly for my purposes, shares what Derrida has called the becoming space of time, the poem beyond the last thought, standing at the edge of space, the strange loop of temporality of what is past or passing or to come that can only be revealed, it seems, in and through the artifice of eternity, in Yeats's memorable words, by something that is not temporal but technical, whose technicity enables and makes manifest temporality. In fact, what we find here is a quintessential example of the relationship between materialization and temporality, whose name in deconstruction is the trace. As Martin Hagelin explains it in his book on Derrida, the classical distinction between space and time is the distinction between simultaneity and succession. The spatial can remain the same, since the simultaneity of space allows for one point to coexist with another. In contrast, the temporal can never remain the same. By the same token, however, it is clear that time is impossible without space. Time is nothing but negation, so in order to be anything, it has to be spatialized. The very concept of duration presupposes that something remains across an interval of time, and only that which is spatial can remain. Inversely, without temporalization, it would be impossible for a point to remain the same as itself or to exist at the same time as another point. The simultaneity of space is itself a temporal notion. Accordingly, for one point to be simultaneous with another point, there must be an originary becoming time of space that relates them to one another. The structure of the trace, as the co-implication of time and space, is therefore the condition of everything that is temporal. Everything that is subjected to succession is subjected to the trace, whether it's alive or not. Yeats's poem, having rejected the birds and the trees early on in the poem, as part of whatever is begotten, born, and dies, a land that is no country for old men, which is where Cormac McCarthy got his title, opts in this regal last two stanzas for the artifice of eternity as its antidote, and associates that with the figure of sovereignty, the drowsy emperor, the lords and ladies who are the proper audience for the bird's song. But the question for Stevens, remembering the etymological associations of the rain, -reign, in both sovereign and foreign, with out of doors and outside, is, you might say, the sovereignty of the foreign, and how to make the foreign, truly outside. And here it seems, Stevens locates the sovereignty of the foreign neither in the organic nor in the technical, neither in the dying generations, as he puts it, nor in the artifice of eternity, but in their radical co-implication, which has a kind of galvanizing effect on the mode of attention registered in the poem. Or as Hagelin characterizes it, time is best thought of in terms of survival, and Yeats's poem is very much about survival, of course, but on the model of Derrida's French neologism of survivance, which designates something that is neither life nor death, pure and simple, a survival that, quote, does not hinge on the emergence of life. Consequently, he continues, quote, one can make explicit a continuity between the non-living and the living in terms of the arche materiality of time. The latter is implicit not only in our understanding of the temporality of living processes, but also in our understanding of the disintegration of inanimate matter. Crucially, however, he continues, there's an asymmetry between the animate and the inanimate in the arche materiality of the trace. As soon as there is life, there is death, so there can be no animation without the inanimate. But the inverse argument does not hold. If there were animation as soon as there is inanimate matter, we would be advocating a vitalist conception of the universe, unquote. To put it this way is to realize that life, or nature, rather than being a site of fullness, positivity, identity, and non-supplementarity, a force that's transmitted without corruption and mediation, as it were, from the bird's song to our ear, is importantly in a relationship of difference and asynchronicity and spacing and strangeness to itself. Let me emphasize now that this is far from a purely philosophical matter, because this is precisely what we find in birdsong, where this fundamental dynamic is registered not just ontogenetically, but phylogenetically, as a site of double inscription and materialization, not just in the vocal learning that rewires the brain's plasticity in both humans and birds, but also in how that learning and that rewiring are performatively manifest at particular moments in particular contexts for which the axiological function of mating and territory are only the tip of the iceberg. We learn just how small that tip is when Ackerman reports on, and this is a very funny observation, I think, when Ackerman reports, quote, on a crested lark in southern Germany that learned to imitate the four whistling notes a shepherd used to work his herding dogs. So faithful were the imitations that the dogs instantly obeyed the bird's whistled commands, which included run ahead, fast, halt, and come here. These whistled calls subsequently spread to other larks, creating a little pocket of local catchphrases and quite possibly some very exhausted sheepdogs, unquote, what she calls a fine example of cultural transmission in birds. But it's also true phylogenetically, namely in the relationship between the genetic and epigenetic factors at work in birdsong at different points in time in the animal's development. As she notes, a zebra finch, for example, grows up hearing all sorts of songs of different species in the surrounding environment, but it only learns the song of its own species, a clear case of genetic predisposition or hardwiring. But, quote, baby birds raised without any exposure to a tutor sing abnormally, usually a very stunted, simplified version of the species song, unquote, the result of a weak feedback loop between genetic predisposition, neurophysiological plasticity, and environment. But what's most interesting, and here we enter the domain of epigenetics, is that the effects of this feedback loop are nonlinear. She quotes ornithologist Sarah London from the University of Chicago, quote, a tutor song actually alters a young bird's brain in a way that affects his future ability to learn. Her research shows that young birds with a tutor learn just fine until the age of 65 days, but after that, learning diminishes rapidly and the song remains fixed for life. But birds isolated from a tutor can go on learning well after the 65-day mark. Quote, the experience of hearing another bird singing, she writes, apparently alters the song-learning genes of the learning bird through epigenetic effects. In this case, says London, through the action of histones, proteins that coat DNA and allow genes to be turned on and off, unquote. What this means is that what we call the living is a site of a triple inscription, not just on the material substrate of the living being, as for an example in the rewiring of the bird's plasticity that results in the difference between its genetically predisposed songs and those it can learn, and not just in the dynamic contingency of the system-environment or organism-environment relationship in which that inscription happens, which can make the same inscription function differently at different points in time, as in the actualization of innate versus learned songs in their accented versus unaccented forms, as we already talked about, but also in how those two prior inscriptions are taken up, not just by human auditors in terms of their own ontogenetic and phylogenetic contingencies, in this case, hey, I've read Shelley and I've read Keats, but also, as we saw earlier in the herding dog example, in a broader and not exclusively human process of cultural transmission. To put it this way is not to say that humans and birds, human poems and bird songs are the same. And here we should remember Hollander's speech being watched in its transcribed form. On the contrary, it's to say that biologistic continuism must give way to what Henry Statton has called the strong naturalistic view, which holds that life emerges from matter organized in particular ways and not others, while rejecting the idea that, quote, life is somehow hidden in matter and just waiting to manifest itself, unquote. In this light, it means that both human poems and bird songs are subjected to the double finitude that I touched on at the beginning of this talk, how the meanings made by embodied beings are subjected to and made possible by something radically not them and not theirs, something, in fact, radically not living, that nonetheless can give rise to the living and the contingency and creativity of its expression in song. This means that epistemological, then, last paragraph, isn't the opposite of environmental, but in fact means environmental in this very specific sense. You can't take embodiment seriously of whatever form of life without also taking epistemological questions seriously. Because if epistemology is precisely the study of how we know things, then those modes of knowledge and experience of the world depend directly on what Maturana and Varela, two theoretical biologists, call the embodied inaction that is a product of the recursive loop between an organism's wetware and how it gets rewired by its interactions with its environment. And it also means, I think, a much more complex understanding of ecological poetics in its especially modern form, or modernist form, in Frost, Stevens, and beyond, which is not about representing and, as it were, cheering for nature, but rather of showing how ecology in literature is not always where you think it is. Thank you.